Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. They say if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. But for Chef Ryan Pruitt of Pesh Seafood Grill, things are just heating up. Ryan traveled all the way to Uruguay, where walls of fire are used to cook entire meals out in the open. We visit the Pesh kitchen to see how Ryan's reproduced this experience indoors in New Orleans Warehouse District. Then, we speak with Brian Landry of Bourne Restaurant, who created an easy way to cold smoke food in any home kitchen, and he'll tell us how. Finally, we'll cool things down with a rollicking cocktail tour conducted by Richard Reed, Elizabeth Pierce, and Allison Alsop, authors of the French Quarter Drinking Companion. Light the fire and prepare to cool off on this week's Louisiana Eats. In New Orleans Warehouse District, Chef Ryan Pruitt cooks Gulf seafood on open fire over hardwood coals. Ryan's a member of the Fatback Collective, as well as executive chef at Pesh Seafood Grill. On a busy weekday morning, Ryan welcomed us into the Pesh kitchen, where he described his experience studying South American live fire cooking. Take us back to how the concept of live fire cooking came into your life and how it changed it.
So it came in during a trip I took with a bunch of friends of mine to Uruguay. And really, it was just this whole collective of chefs and food people that all went down there halfway on vacation, but, you know, halfway as a way to sort of educate ourselves about the way that other people were cooking. Traveling down there with a bunch of sort of barbecue cooks led us to this, basically cooking with these guys kind of in an open, in a field, and cooking with their sort of traditional methods, which involved using fire in a way that was just entirely new to me. They are literally building walls of fire, just huge stacks of wood that they just set on fire. I mean, the fire is so hot that they're putting metal pots, you know, handmade metal pots within a few feet of it, and the water is boiling. Like, you can't even get up close to it. And they're pulling the coals that fall through a grate they have the fire burning in, and then cooking over them in either low heat or a high heat situation, or burying pots in it. And it was just this sort of entire kitchen where the cooking method was based on this giant amount of fire. I mean, that's kind of their thing. I mean, this whole like idea of cooking out in the open, this is what they do and kind of how they do it. And they were all very sort of matter of fact about what they were doing. But just seeing how you're able to use so many different levels, from the slow cooking to high heat searing to using the full power of the fire and everything in between, was just completely new and different.
You had been long involved with Donald Link and Steven Strzajewski, of course, who are the famous chef owners of Donald Has Herb Saint. They have Cochon together, and you had been the chef at Herb Saint, and you've been working within this group for about 8 years. So you come home from Uruguay, and how do you all decide to take what you've learned and apply it in a new restaurant?
So we had been talking about opening a seafood restaurant for years, and, you know, we were kind of wrestling with what direction the restaurant was going to go. You know, where it all kind of came together is we sort of all fell in love with these cooking techniques. We wanted to open a seafood restaurant, and we just sort of merged the two. It was really a pretty easy merger. You know, the ideas of cooking seafood over fire, I mean, grilled fish tastes great. You know, shrimp on a grill tastes great. And all these things, you know, these are sort of proven concepts. Where it really came together for us is that we wanted it to all happen over an actual wood fire device, kind of move away from the gas grills and those sort of more controlled cooking elements and have something that has more life to it, that has more energy. And the way that it sort of blossomed and to give us this whole realm of things that we can do with the grill and the ways that we can steer seafood in sort of interesting ways, interesting but not unfamiliar ways, you know, has been really rewarding.
So the cooking system that you use here, you all designed yourself.
Mm-hmm. We did. We designed it over the course of a couple of months, lots of napkin drawings, and then we were lucky to have a very talented welder in Donald's cousin, Dwayne Link, who was able to sort of take our scribblings and various measurements and ideas and fabricate something that really is better than we ever could have imagined.
Well, now that we've heard the story, can we please go back to the kitchen and see this amazing fire in action?
Absolutely. Let's go check it out.
Ryan took us back into the Pesh kitchen to show off their amazing creation. Monopolizing a large portion of his line was a smoking hot open grill. A stack of logs over 3 feet in height burned in a closed iron box to the left of the grill. As the logs turned into glowing coals, the cooks scraped them across the fire bricks, providing some impressive direct heat. Cleverly, the grill was designed so that up to 7 metal racks could be positioned over the fiery coals to provide different levels of heat.
So the first thing you notice is that it's hot.
Wow, it's really hot.
But, you know, we have a separate air conditioning unit back here. You know, we thought that we had sort of spent enough time putting it together. We're a couple of weeks in. The guy that's working the grill, I see him start to get a little woozy and light. Tell him to take a break. He drinks some water. A couple of minutes later, he literally just falls out on the floor back here. We bring him back to life and realize that we've got to take some other steps. So we have this floor fan that we use to blow air across the bottom. We installed this door to make sure that we deflect all the heat backwards. When you shut the door, it's a lot cooler.
I see.
There's no getting around the fact that there's a lot of wood burning in there. It's hot. You know, the wood will go about halfway back. Beyond that, it's almost impossible to reach your hand back there and do anything. So anything beyond that, it's got residual heat. It's usually fine. But you see it's kind of sloped here.
Yeah.
So everything at the front, when we stack the wood underneath here, that's where it's really hot. That's where we can really sear things. And if we want to sort of sear something and then slow cook it, we can sear it and slide it to the back or slide it up here and then kind of finish them up here.
And then over on the far right-hand side, the furthest away from the fire next to the grill, there's a metal box.
Right.
That the door's closed. What goes on in the metal box?
So this is our most recent toy that Dwayne built us. But I had been talking to him about building us a smoker. And I wanted to build a completely, you know, enclosed smoker that could also double as a high-temperature oven. And so we'll take coals from here, put some logs in there, shovel the coals on top of it. We put pans of ice in there, and then we can cold smoke things. So cold smoke cured fish, whatever we're sort of doing when you don't want to cook anything and just apply smoke as a flavoring element. Additionally, we can pull the ice out. We can load it up with wood. We have what is really the most important tool in the entire kitchen.
That is hilarious. To me, it looks to me like that's a blow dryer. What is that?
That's exactly it. It's a dryer tube attached to a hair dryer.
With duct tape and aluminum foil.
Yeah. We use it to force oxygen into the fire. So if you're sort of in the middle of service, you know, there's no knob that you can crank the heat up on, and maybe the wood is a little wet and you're kind of in trouble, you know, you can sort of come in here, turn the hair dryer on, and then all of a sudden you can have this sort of raging fire.
Wow.
But we built this into the system here, so if we want to use it as an oven, we have a pipe that has holes coming off of it that we can turn this on, and it shoots oxygen into the fire and we'll stoke it up so that it gets hotter.
Aside from your electric billows hair dryer, mm-hmm. are there any other special tools that you're using in this kitchen that you wouldn't find in an ordinary restaurant kitchen.
Yes, this sort of the other really important device is this sort of metal shepherd's crook.
Yeah.
And this is a Dwayne Link invention, but it's got a flat point on it and then a metal rod, and you use it to sort of reach under and scrape the coals around it. And this is the tool that makes the fire work. You know, you take it, you can ram it into the wood, you know, it's solid metal, you know, it's very strong. Additionally, you can use it to sort of control where you put the fuel, how you sort of design the heat on the grill grates, whether you want to pull it forward, push it back, or clear it out to the side altogether. We don't use it just during service. Like the flavor of the grill, the cooking apparatus itself, we've really tried to apply to everything. You know, we've put everything from oysters to every vegetable you can imagine, either in the grill, in the coals, on the grill, in the smoker. You know, it really leads to a lot of, you know, the sort of creative juices start flowing. And when all of our market produce comes in, whatever we're getting, you sort of look at it through new eyes. You know, you look at broccoli, you think of all the ways you can cook broccoli, and then you look at the grill and you think, we can grill that broccoli, or can we smoke this broccoli, or can we just grill, smoke, roast it to death and make a puree out of it, you know? And you sort of start looking at all of your produce and vegetables in a different way. And after spending so many years with stoves and saute pans and ovens, and you know, you run through all these methods and you're constantly reading and trying to educate yourself, and then you're sort of confronted with this contraption, and it just, the whole kitchen, it leads to this creativity that's brand new for everybody. I mean, none of the cooks here have ever worked on anything like this, and so we all sort of get to look at it as a brand new device.
That was Ryan Pruitt, chef at New Orleans Pesh Seafood Grill. Not everyone has access to the kind of live fire at Pesh, but cold smoking is another matter entirely. Chef Brian Landry of Bourne Restaurant is a master of fish cookery. Brian's here to tell us how you can cold smoke your favorite seafood in your home oven.
I think everyone's fairly familiar with hot smoking, where you're introducing smoke to a product you would, let's say, be grilling, and a high temperature is involved. What we're going to be talking about today is cold smoking, where we actually don't want the temperature of our product to be cooked with heat. In most cases, we'll be curing the product, like the salmon or the smoked pompano, and then introducing smoke to it without raising the temperature.
Do some foods adapt better to cold smoking versus hot smoking?
They do, and it also just depends on what the end product you are looking for. For example, smoked salmon is a cured product, but you can also hot smoke salmon. It just depends on what your desired outcome is.
Would you take us through this actual process?
Sure. In the case of the smoked pompano, what we do is we actually brine the fish before we're going to smoke it. So we would do a mixture of water, salt, sugar, peppercorns, bay leaf, fresh thyme, and we'll soak the pompano in that brine for about 8 hours. So it'd be just like if you were brining chicken or turkey or pork chop. We're actually brining the fish. Once it's been brined for 8 hours, we would then take it out of that brine, rinse it, pat it dry, and just leave it uncovered in refrigeration for another 8 hours. In the case of salmon, we would not use a brine. We would just make a salt and sugar mixture and pour that right on top of the salmon, and that'll help pull out some of the moisture. We then rinse that salt, pat it dry, and we'll actually let it sit up to 3 days uncovered in refrigeration until a sticky film called pellicle forms. Once that sticky film has formed on the salmon, that's when we know it's time to smoke.
I imagine many of our listeners, they don't have a smoker. They may not even have a spot to put a smoker. So can you tell us, how can you accomplish this trick without that conventional equipment?
Sure. What we always try to do is keep the temperature of the oven from rising. We want it to stay at room temperature. So we always put an ice barrier in between our heat source, which is where our smoke will come from, and the product that we're smoking.
You're starting off with a totally cold oven.
Correct.
Okay.
Not turned on, just hanging out at room temperature.
Okay. And then what happens?
So what we use to smoke in this case is something called smoke dust. And it actually looks like something you would find in the bottom of a hamster cage. It's wood chips that have been finely shaved. They come in all kinds of different wood varieties. We typically would use hickory or pecan, but you can buy cherry wood, apple wood, anything you can imagine. So once you have your smoke dust, you just put that in any kind of small container, a small metal bowl, small foil container. And then we would take charcoal, 2, 3, 4 briquettes, and we actually just put those right on top of our stove and turn the burner on. And once the charcoal is white hot, we would then add the charcoal to our container of smoke dust. We put that on the very bottom of the oven. On the first rack of the oven, we'll then put a container of ice. So any heat given off by those 3 or 4 charcoal briquettes is absorbed by the ice. On the second and third rack of the oven would be the product that we want to smoke, whether that be duck breast or pompano or salmon.
Or shrimp.
Soft shell crabs. That's another great one. So your smoke with your heat source, which is the charcoal, is on the very bottom of the oven. Then on the first rack would be ice. And then on all racks above that, second, third, fourth rack, would be whatever product you're going to smoke.
And how long does this take?
For something like salmon or pompano, we would typically just let it smoke for about 45 minutes to an hour. For something like a pork chop or a duck breast, we might let it go double that, an hour and a half to an hour and 45 minutes.
Something as tiny as a shrimp?
Same thing, same as the fish, about 45 minutes would be plenty.
Well, this was a culinary secret that I must admit is all news to me. So thanks for sharing this with us today, Brian, and thanks for coming to see us on Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me.
Chef Brian Landry of Bourne Restaurant. How do you make sure your fish is fresh and stays that way? Stay tuned, and we'll have all the answers about storing and cooking finfish when we come back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you make sure your fish is fresh and stays that way? The first secret is keep it cold, really cold. That's 32 to 38 degrees Fahrenheit. Fishermen, the minute you reel in the big one, cover it with ice in your ice chest. Whether you do your fishing at the grocery store or on the water, it's a good idea to ice filleted fish even when it's stored in the fridge. Every 5-degree reduction results in a marked loss of shelf life. For instance, fish held at 50 degrees will spoil 5 times faster than fish stored at 32 degrees. And when you're buying fish, trust your eyes and your nose. Fish eyes should be shiny and clear, and their gills a bright red. And there should be no fishy smell. Really fresh fish has a pleasant aroma with no hint of ammonia. I'm Poppy Tooker, and fresh fish from the Gulf are real Louisiana eats. Chef Christina Quackenbush's restaurant, Milkfish, is currently the only Louisiana restaurant featuring authentic Filipino cuisine. Previously, just a pop-up, Chef Christina has finally achieved her goal of opening a permanent location for her restaurant in New Orleans mid-city. Recently, I tasted her Filipina-style ceviche and was simply wowed. If you're a fan of ceviche, you've probably experienced the South of the Border style, where lime juice is the acid used to cook the fresh fish. The Filipino version is very different and actually creamy. I sweet-talked Chef Christina into sharing her recipe with our Louisiana Eats listeners. In the Philippines, grouper is usually the fish of choice, but here Christina uses fresh Louisiana drum. The fish fillets are cut into half-inch cubes and then covered with coconut vinegar, an ingredient easily obtained in any Asian grocery. Then, 2 teaspoons of salt and 1 tablespoon each of fresh grated ginger and fresh chopped chilies are added for each pound of fish. The fish cooks itself by marinating in the refrigerator for at least 4 hours. To finish the preparation, all of the liquid is strained off of the fish, and she adds a can of unsweetened coconut milk, chopped green mango, purple onion, and bell pepper. For a copy of Christina's Milkfish Filipino Ceviche, visit our website at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Chris J. is a food blogger for the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau. You can find his weekly blog every Tuesday on 20by49.com. He's also our Louisiana Eats roving reporter for the north part of our state. So, Chris, take us up to northern Louisiana and tell us what's going on.
I'd love to, Poppy. I wanted to tell you about a place called the Mabry House. It's a converted Victorian mansion in Shreveport's Highland neighborhood, which is a fun, funky little neighborhood, probably the most unique in the whole community. And they serve really old school, upscale fine dining with no sense of irony whatsoever. I mean, this is very straight-faced, baked Alaska flambe for dessert, you know, a veal Oscar on the menu, crawfish cheesecake type, kind of very staid, kind of relic from a bygone era that's still kicking and thriving.
Well, you know, I'm really glad to hear there's someplace like that in Shreveport because, after all, down in New Orleans, we have places like Galatoire's and Antoine's and Toujac's, and there's a sense of tradition like that even in North Louisiana.
Absolutely, and that's what I thought was so fascinating about it. If you're looking for a Galatoire's-level experience in Shreveport, Mabry House is the place to go. I mean, it's definitely the only restaurant in North Louisiana with, like, a Griardin. You know, I mean, these people are, there's a very strict hierarchy in the kitchen and in the service staff. I've been there probably 3 or 4 times. It's a special occasion place for my wife and I, and I've never seen the server smile. They never crack a smile, but you turn around and they're there. You know what I mean?
It's the service is impeccable.
Absolutely.
And the food is very, very consistent.
I mean,
for over 30 years. Huh?
Absolutely. It's only candlelight. I mean, there's no electric light in the place. It's insane.
So who's the chef? Has it stayed the same the entire time?
Yes. His name's Steve Mylar. He and his wife, Ginger, run the place. What I love about it is it lets me kind of take a vacation in a reality of our community, Shreveport-Bossier, that may have disappeared for a lot of people. I mean, it opened up in the heyday of the oil and gas boom, you know, when I'm sure it did great guns business. But things have changed a lot. But they've hung on to their clientele, and in a way, they've sort of preserved that whole era of affluence and boom. You know what I mean? When Sarah and I go, we love to kind of walk past the Bugattis in the parking lot and just kind of, you know, think, hopefully they won't find out who we are and bust us back down to our normal place in society.
I imagine that it's jackets only.
It is. It's a very formal atmosphere, but something about that's fun. I mean, I come from a generation of food lovers that I think we were taught to sort of ridicule that sort of dining. The places that we're eating are more contemporary, and we kind of think those old school places are funny, but you really need to experience it. You need to go do it. Have the baked Alaska flambé for Pete's sakes before you just, you know, laugh at it in old cookbooks.
Okay, I'm bringing my party dress the next time I come north.
Wonderful. We'll get you a spot at the chef's table.
Chris J., our Louisiana Eats Northwestern roving reporter. Travelers and locals alike, picking a place to grab a drink in the French Quarter with its wealth of watering holes can be daunting.
For me as a traveler, and I'll admit it, a drinker, when I come to a city that I'm not familiar with, I want to know a little bit more. I want the insider's take on what these bars, what these restaurants and clubs are like. So I think one of the most telling ways to do that is to figure out who it is that you're drinking with. You know, just apart from the bartender and what their specials are and all the decor and all that, the clientele tells you whether you're going to be comfortable there.
That was Richard Reed, who, along with Allison Alsop and Elizabeth Pierce, set out to do just that with their book, The French Quarter Drinking Companion. We're here to ask them about their insights into the abundance of bars in the Vieux Carré.
Well, first, we made a list of every establishment that we could identify as a place where you could get a drink. And that number was enormous. So we began to eliminate. We eliminated strip clubs because you don't go there to drink. And then we looked at, there are lots of restaurants where you can drink. So we tried to only feature restaurants that had some element that was notable about drinking there. An example would be the Bourbon House, because it has over 100 different bourbons that you can try. And then we just had the list of bars. And this list was acquired by walking up and down the streets of the French Quarter. And then we began to discuss and argue for and against. And so we pared it down to something that was manageable to begin.
So you actually cover about 100 bars. I want to know what the hardest part in doing this really tough research was.
Well, I think the hardest part that in the end turned out to be a gift, really, was for me personally, I really thought that I would dislike covering the Bourbon Street bars. I thought, like a lot of locals, you know, this is a street, you just hold your breath, you put on your game face, you just quickly dart across the street and you get on to your other destination. But one of the surprises in the end was that even though we kept a lot of those Bourbon Street bars to the end of our research, it's just how much I ended up really enjoying Bourbon Street and seeing its purpose, its place, its need in the city. And also along the way, the little places that you can go on Bourbon, like Johnny White's or Fritzl's or the old Absinthe House, where they feel different from the rest of the streets. Kind of step in and get a little refuge, but still be able to, in this very voyeuristic way, look out onto Bourbon Street and see all the action.
For each bar that you cover, there are a list of questions that you answer right off the bat, and that includes what your bar tab will be, what you're wearing, what you're hearing. Now, I have to say, I kind of stopped with tattoo themes. Why did we put tattoo themes in this book, y'all?
I will take the credit or blame for that. When I was much younger, I thought briefly that I would have a career as a cultural anthropologist. And I got kind of obsessed for a while with tattoos and sort of figuring out which cliques, which groups of people had which sorts of tattoos. For example, the sorts of tattoos that maybe motorcycle riders get are different than the sorts that sorority girls get, you know, on a weekend in New Orleans. So to me, the tattoos are really an extension of the dress code, because to me, they tell you as much about the people as anything. They're indicative of particular trends, what people are into, and also age. God bless them, the people with the Elton John tattoos or the Ziggy tattoos are, you know, from one era. The people with the Betty Page tattoos are from another era. So to me, they're very telling. Maybe they'll be telling to some readers. If not, gloss over them and no harm done.
I also think that the presence or absence of tattoos, or whether they're covered, is something that's noted. And I evacuated to Oxford, Mississippi for Katrina, and something that I was very aware of within days of drinking there, though I do not have a tattoo, I was very aware while out drinking that I never saw any. And I realized that I was not in New Orleans anymore.
This is the trick question. You know, I love to end with a trick question. Let's pretend an awful, terrible thing. What if it is last call for y'all in New Orleans? What is your favorite bar? What is the bar that you would choose to end your time here with?
I know. I absolutely know. Because I've thought about this a lot, the way that people think about their last meal.
Yes.
My last drink would be made by Chris Hanna at French 75, and it would be an old-fashioned. The old-fashioned is my mother's favorite drink, Carolyn Talley Pierce, who is a model in teaching me how to drink. And it is the drink that I grew up sipping. My entire drinking and non-drinking life is flavored with the elements of bourbon, bitters, and sugar. And French 75 is intimate and beautiful, and I can't think of a better way to leave.
Richard, how about you?
I wish I were that classy. But my last drink would probably be a domestic beer, light, if you please, at the Golden Lantern, ideally on Christmas Eve. There is a Christmas Eve drag show that happens at the Golden Lantern that is, I don't know if you've ever seen the John Waters movie Pink Flamingos, but there's this party scene that takes place at the trailer that is just a complete bacchanal. That is the only way to describe it, and that is the polite, like, family-friendly way of describing it. That's all I need. I need one good, very cold beer surrounded by a glorious freak show. You're not going to find that anywhere else.
And what about you, Allison?
This is a really tough question because I want to go both in the direction of Richard and in the direction of Elizabeth. So I'm going to say it's a tie between the Sazerac at the Sazerac Bar in the Roosevelt Hotel, which, by the way, is the only bar that is not actually in the French Quarter, but that we had to make an exception for. And it gets my vote because of the tremendous service that you get in that bar. For $10, sitting down in one of those seats and water carafe brought to you, little Chex Mix brought to you, and it's windowless. So if the end of the world was coming, you wouldn't see it. You could pretend. That or sucking down shooters at Crazy Corner, absolutely day glow, alcohol, party till dawn until you just all die. One of those two.
Now that we've heard what compelled the authors of the French Quarter Drinking Companion to write their book, when we come back, we'll hit the streets for cocktails in some very unlikely locations. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Richard Reed, Elizabeth Pierce, and Allison Alsop, authors of the French Quarter Drinking Companion. After hearing about the motivation behind the book, we set off to tour some of the more obscure bars in the Quarter. Our first stop, Vacherie, a hotel bar at the corner of Toulouse and Dauphine. The bar was crowded, so once we got our drinks, we huddled together under the outdoor awning, avoiding a sudden rain shower. Not a bad way to spend the afternoon, as Allison pointed out.
We all know that drinking is an established tradition in the French Quarter, but sometimes we don't really stop to question why it is that it works so awfully well here. And one of the reasons is that it is just so simply easy. Unlike other places where you have to go and park and struggle and then take your car from bar to bar, here we just park, if you have had a car at all, and either on foot or rickshaw or carriage, make your way through the quarter. And so part of the experience that we tried to capture in the book was not only just the experience of sitting in the bar, but of the actual ambulatory nature of meandering through the quarter, and that part of the entertainment is actually what's happening between the bars as well.
Richard, in the book, one of the points that you all make is that drinking is fundamental to the identity of New Orleans. Explain that.
I don't know that I can explain it too well, except to say that I would compare it to, say, the fascination that we have with festivals here. And what is so interesting to me about festivals is that festivals are sort of low commitment. You go to Jazz Fest, you have something at this booth, you have something at that booth, you hear a little music at this stage, a little music at that stage, and then you move on. And the way that we drink in the quarter is very much the same. You go into a place, you don't particularly like the crowd, but they serve you a good drink. You can put it in a go cup and you can walk on to the next one. There's a very low threshold of commitment. It's not like you're stuck in one place. I won't name places in the United States where you're stuck there all night, but we all know what we're talking about, where you can't step outside with a drink. It's not like that at all here. It's just it's a relaxing way to go about an evening.
Elizabeth, we're standing just outside of Vacherie, where there is a bar that I know you're particularly fond of. Why is that?
Well, I have become fond of Vacherie, and partially because of one of the bartenders who works here. Her name is Victoria, and she used to serve me liberally and often at Le Chat Noir, which was a cabaret that closed a few years ago, and she moved over here. If you walk into Vacherie, you wouldn't include it maybe with some of the iconic locations that a lot of people think about when they think about drinking in the French Quarter, like Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop or Pat O'Brien's. But I think Vacherie embodies a particular kind of drinking that's really important in the French Quarter, and that is the hotel bar, where Victoria has shared with me she has acquired a different kind of regular. It's the regular who is staying in the hotel, who over a period of 3 or 5 days comes and drinks in her bar once, or I have seen several times. I have come in at the beginning of a tour, and there were some folks who were finishing to go out and go get dinner. And when I returned, they were coming back to finish their night there. And so she gets to know people, even if it's over just, you know, a small period. But the other thing that she pointed out, and this is the other thing tourists forget, is that the French Quarter is a neighborhood. People live here, people work here, and on any given evening, if you walk into the bar at Vacherie, the bar is full of locals who live within, you know, a 2-block stumbling radius. They are not unlike the hotel guests who stop in on their way out or on their way back. So it isn't the neighborhood bar that we would normally imagine in most areas of New Orleans, but the hotel bar serves its local clientele as much as it might serve a tourist.
So where are we going to go next, guys?
Well, I would suggest, since we're on Dauphine Street already, that we go for something that's a little more... A little more upbeat, maybe, than where we are right now at Vacherie, which is a very calm, sedate, sort of relaxing bar. We'll go to Good Friends, which is a nice halfway point. It's a great place for a relaxing drink, but if you want something a little more peppy, you can get that there, too.
Okay, let's go. We walked a few blocks down Dauphine Street while the rain continued to fall. By the time we arrived at Good Friends, several regulars had already taken up residence at the bar. I asked Richard what makes this bar stand out among others in the French Quarter.
Well, Good Friends is obvious, is on what we in New Orleans, what the LGBT community calls the Fruit Loop, which is actually more of an L than a technical loop. And every bar on the loop is a little different. So you have Lafitte's in Exile, you have the Pub in Oz, you have Good Friends, and you have Rawhide. And what I love about Good Friends is that while the music here is certainly energetic and it's a fun place to meet friends and hang out, it can be a very relaxing place. It's a great place to come at the end of the night if you're looking for a nightcap, or if you're just sort of starting out the evening and you want to ease into it. You can have a very civilized drink. They have a great selection of liqueurs, cognacs, that sort of stuff. There's a little bar upstairs that's totally charming and friendly. If you're here when the weather is great, there's a balcony. Great people watching, especially during some of the festivals like Southern Decadence and obviously during Carnival. It's right in the middle of all that. But it's also like a little oasis. It's kind of calm and quiet. It's not... The music never gets too loud. You can always have a great conversation. And that, to me, what is the hallmark of a great bar, is a place where you can have a really good conversation.
You know, I was particularly fascinated when I read the French Quarter Drinking Companion to read that term, the Fruit Loop, because I had never heard that before. And I even paused and I said to myself, is that even politically correct?
I would just say that that's one of those words we have to own. That is, honestly, it's been called that since I was a kid. And kind of disparagingly, but always with a warmth. It's just one of those places that when you have guests in town, you want to take them to the Fruit Loop because it's a great array of bars. And not only that, but you can walk from one to the other. It's a little sampler platter of everything that the community has to offer. Not absolutely everything. There are some others that lie off the beaten path a little more, like La Roundup and Corner Pocket. But this gives you a pretty good lay of the land. Also, there's always something happening down here. There's always some sort of contest or drag show or something like that to keep you entertained and occupied that you're not going to see in wherever it is that you're from. I would also add that, to me, that whole mixture, that mélange, is really what makes drinking in the Quarter so interesting to me. You go to other cities and you go drinking, and it doesn't matter if you're a straight bar, a gay bar, or someplace in between. Each bar has its own type. You know, you go to one bar and it's a little preppy, and another is a little more rock and roll. And so many bars here in the French Quarter, like, you walk into the Abbey, is my favorite example. The Abbey, and you're standing there, and it's, you know, people who have just gotten off a shift. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they've just worked for 8 hours in a very, very hot restaurant kitchen, and they're standing next to some goth kids from out in the suburbs who are standing next to a wedding couple who just got hitched and are just sort of stumbled out of their own wedding reception, next to some, you know, debutante who just wandered down the street from Maximo's. Who knows who you're going to be rubbing shoulders with? And I think the LGBT bars are a great example of that in action. It's open to anybody.
So, Elizabeth, where are we going to go next?
Well, it's not a trip to the Quarter unless you go to Bourbon Street. So we're going to head down to Johnny White's Hole in the Wall, number 2.
The weather cleared up significantly as we traipsed towards Bourbon Street, dodging empty beer cans and puddles of rain under a sea of flashing neon lights. We ducked into a small bar in the 7th block of New Orleans' most notorious street. I am most surprised to learn of the existence of Johnny White's 2. Like, I knew about Johnny White's, which is over across from Pat O'Brien's and very famous for a lot of reasons, but what's this place about and why did you want to come here?
Well, you're not alone in not knowing this bar. In fact, I think very few New Orleanians know about this bar. But I wanted to come down here for a few reasons. Number one, I wanted to make sure that we were on Bourbon Street at some point. But in our book, we're constantly noting the things that others might pass by or that even locals might know about, and I felt like this bar was definitely one of them. We're on Bourbon, all of the mayhem of Bourbon is happening just outside of these doors, and yet you can just step through this little set of French doors and enter into this very narrow bar, which takes us back to the history of New Orleans when Bourbon Street was not the mayhem that it is now, but was this premier residential street. And Johnny White's, if you look closely, you can still see in the architecture here the signs that we were in someone's salon, their parlor, their living room, and that this house used to just step out and onto this residential street. We've got a mantle in front of us. We still have some of the woodwork on the walls. And if you look towards the front of the bar, you can see the beam that probably led out onto the porch. So this is one place that I think, just when you think that you have figured out the quarter or figured out bourbon, it throws you a little surprise, and it always offers something if you look just a little bit closer.
So Johnny White's itself, you know, has this legendary presence, right? As, you know, the bar that never closed or whatever. But what I really responded to was the bartender's delight in how it shifts through the day from one kind of clientele to the other. Like a sundial sort of moving around in this circle, the clientele of Johnny White's changes and can't be pinned down to only one description.
Yeah, just something I wanted to kind of follow up on that is in the times that I have been in the hole in the wall here and also in Johnny White's number one, I think both of the Johnny White's bars has that feel. You can come in, you don't need to know anyone, you can easily strike up a conversation with the bartender or who's sitting next to you. It might be over the game or what's playing on the jukebox, but this is an easy bar to come into and made to be feel welcome. And there are some bars in this world where you feel like you have to show up with someone else, and there's other bars in this world where you can come in alone. And this is a bar that you can come in alone and have no issue with it whatsoever.
That's A Day in the Vieux Carré with the authors of The French Quarter Drinking Companion. Available online or in bookstores now. Join us on Thursday, August the 27th at the Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum when Times-Picayune food writers Judy Walker and Marcel Bienvenu help host our first Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Judy and Marcel's Cooking Up a Storm is being reissued in a special hardcover edition. We'll be cooking up a storm with Judy and Marcel, and eating up a storm, too. Brady's Wine Warehouse will provide the wine pairings. What a night this is going to be. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week for part one of our two-part series exploring Katrina's effect on Louisiana's food scene. We examine the damage the storm caused and how food ultimately brought the community back together.
People in the neighborhood, they would always drive by, and they were saying to us, oh yeah, we've been driving by for a few days. And as soon as we saw the door open, we wanted to come in to make sure you guys were coming back. And we were saying, well, we're not really sure. Are you guys coming back? And they were saying, well, we won't come back if you aren't coming back. There's no point. So it sort of, you know, galvanized us. Yeah, it made us
a so much stronger community.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the point, I guess, when you realize this is our home.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Worldline Music Building on Canal Street. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.